Desire and hatred, or envy. But Ichha comes first. Yes. Excuse me, I'm just looking around for... In which 19? Well, it says envious. Those who are envious. Oh, Kuran. Well, Kuran means cruel. I didn't see any other gloss on that word. We can look in the dictionary, but I wanted to try to let's see where. I'm kind of lost now. Bhagavad Gita. Oh, okay. Where am I going now? Well, yeah, you should pause. When we pause, you should pause. Bloody, raw, cruel, fierce, ferocious, pitiless, harsh, formidable, inauspicious. Set of the first, third, fifth, seventh, ninth, and 11th signs of the zodiac, which is supposed to have malignant influence. Hard, solid, strong, hot, sharp, formidable. Yeah. So that's the meaning. It is quite strong, huh? Doesn't say mischievous. So I guess Prabhupada's being a little kind upon the demons. Kurata means cruelty. Kuratva, yeah. Generally, cruel, being cruel, that is the general. Like Kuradanti means having bloody or cruel teeth. So it can mean kind of like horrible. Kuradrish means evil-eyed. You know? Kuradrishti, a formidable glance or look. Right? Kurabuddhi, cruel-minded. Yeah, cruel. Okay, now we will... My plan was to read How to Conquer. Don't you want to know this? How to conquer these three? Okay. Now we're quoting from the first canto, chapter 9, text 27 in the commentary. As far as salvation is concerned, one has to conquer the principles of lust, anger, unlawful desires, avarice, and bewilderment. To get freedom from anger, one should learn how to forgive. To be free from unlawful desires, one should not make plans. By spiritual culture, one is able to conquer sleep. By tolerance only, one can conquer desires and avarice. By tolerance. Disturbances from various diseases can be avoided by regulated diets. By self-control, one can be free from false hopes, and money can be saved by avoiding undesirable association. By practice of yoga, one can control hunger. And worldliness can be avoided by cultivating the knowledge of impermanence. Dizziness can be conquered by rising up. And false, good, he knows that one. And false arguments can be conquered by factual ascertainment. Right? That's like Tattva Siddhanta. Right? Talkativeness can be avoided by gravity and silence. And by prowess, one can avoid fearfulness. Perfect knowledge can be obtained by self-cultivation. One must be free from lust, avarice, anger, dreaming, etc. to actually attain the path of salvation. There's another section, from the Bhagavatam, which describes a similar thing. They were talking from, now I'm reading from the 7th canto, chapter 15, starting from text 22. There's four texts, 22 to 25. And they all describe conquering the enemies of the soul. 7:15:22 to 25. Okay, listen, please. By making plans with determination, one should give up lusty desires for sense gratification. Similarly, by giving up envy, one should conquer anger. By discussing the disadvantages of accumulating wealth, one should give up greed. And by discussing the truth, one should give up fear. Purport. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur has suggested how one can conquer lusty desires for sense gratification. You want to hear this? One cannot give up thinking of women, for thinking in this way is natural. Even while walking on the street, one will see so many women. However, if one is determined not to live with a woman, even while seeing a woman, he will not become lusty. This is actually interesting, because one time Jayadvaita Swami, I was talking with him privately, you know, and he said, "Yeah, I could understand why people want to enjoy sex. Yeah, there's pleasure there, and I could see, you know, I could imagine myself enjoying sex with a woman." But I could never imagine living with a woman. Well, I made some face. And so it seems that, you know, even a very advanced sannyasi could, you know, consider that there's some pleasure, but he could never imagine living with a woman. So in this way, this is one very sure way to conquer sex desire. So he says, if one is determined not to have sex, he can automatically conquer lusty desires. The example given in this regard is that even if one is hungry, if on a particular day he's determined to observe fasting, he can naturally conquer the disturbances of hunger and thirst. If one is determined not to be envious of anyone, he can naturally conquer anger. Similarly, one can give up the desire to accumulate wealth simply by considering how difficult it is to protect the money in one's possession. If one keeps a large amount of cash with him, he is always anxious about keeping it properly. Right? Like Sanat Goswami and Ishan and the golden coins, right? Ishan kept one coin. And then Sanat Goswami sent him home. He said, "You're a bad boy, you go home and spend the money in your village." Thus, if one discusses the disadvantages of accumulating wealth, he can naturally give up business. He can give up business without difficulty. Now, 23, the next verse says, "By discussing spiritual knowledge, one can conquer lamentation and illusion. By serving a great devotee, one can become prideless. By serving a great devotee, one can become prideless. By keeping silent, one can avoid obstacles on the path of mystic yoga." And simply by stopping sense gratification, one can conquer envy. Gauralila, is this what you're following? You're always keeping silent. Fixed in Bhagavatam. Text 24. By good behavior and freedom from envy, one should counteract sufferings due to other living entities. By good behavior and freedom from envy, one should counteract sufferings from other living entities. By meditation and trance, one should counteract sufferings due to providence. And by practicing hatha yoga, pranayama, and so forth, one should counteract sufferings due to the body and mind. Similarly, by developing the mode of goodness, especially in regard to eating, one should conquer sleep. Sadhu Sabdham. 25, the last one. One must conquer the modes of passion and ignorance by developing the mode of goodness. And then one must become detached from the mode of goodness by promoting oneself to the Shuddhasattva platform. All this can be automatically done if one engages in the service of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. In this way, one can conquer the influence of the modes of nature. Right? So if you have full devotion and faith in Guru and Krishna, then you don't have to kind of, you know, try to augment or support your practice. Because the faith and devotion and bhakti, that's sufficient to bring everything. But those who don't have full faith and full devotion, who are maybe on the Kanishtha platform, then they can always use these different things to support themselves, to augment their treatment. This is explained also. So if one has faith in the Guru, he can conquer the influence of the modes of nature. Because if one is pure-hearted and has full faith, then he's pleasing the Guru, then the Lord is pleased, and he gets the mercy of them, and then they bring him up to the transcendental platform. So everything's there in bhakti. The problem is that we don't have so much bhakti. So we can increase our bhakti, then everything will come naturally, automatically. But until that time, you know, we can support it with these other things. These things are just secondary, like Varnashram. You know, we also take a little help from the Varnashram system. And so we can also take some help from Gyan Yoga or just Dharma in religious practices. These things help us. I wrote about this in great detail in my book, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that, you know, the accidental path, the path of mercy, doesn't just fall on you, then the other path is needed. So if one doesn't get the mercy of Guru and Krishna through faith and devotion, then the other path of the usual path of practicing, you know, morality and sense control and all of these other things, then those things are necessary. Okay, last two verses. Etervimukta Kaunteya Tamodvarastribhir Naraha Acharatyatmana Shreyas Tato Yati Param Gatim. The man who has escaped these three gates of hell, O son of Kunti, performs acts conducive to self-realization and thus gradually attains the supreme destination. So this is the fruit of giving up the three gates. Prabhupada writes in his purport. And this is right on the topic which we just left. One should be very careful of these three enemies to human life: lust, anger, and greed. The more a person is freed from lust, anger, and greed, the more his existence becomes pure. Then he can follow the rules and regulations enjoined in the Vedic literature. By following the regular principles of human life, one can gradually raise himself to the platform of spiritual realization. So that's what we were just discussing, the regular principles of human life. If one is so fortunate, by such practice, to rise to the platform of Krishna consciousness, see, that comes only through sadhusanga, then success is guaranteed for him. In the Vedic literature, the ways of action and reaction are prescribed to enable one to come to the stage of purification. The whole method is based on giving up lust, greed, and anger. By cultivating knowledge of this process, one can be elevated to the highest position of self-realization. This self-realization is perfected in devotional service. In that devotional service, the liberation of the conditioned soul is guaranteed. Therefore, according to the Vedic system, there are instituted the four orders of life and the four statuses of life, called the caste system and the spiritual order system. There are different rules and regulations for different castes or divisions of society, and if a person is able to follow them, he will be automatically raised to the highest platform of spiritual realization. Then he can have liberation without a doubt. So Bishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has written that to be devoted to Bhagavan is most auspicious. Thus Krishna speaks this shloka. Only theists are sadhus, and they attain the supreme destination. Those who are atheists go to hell. This is the essence of this chapter. And that was his last comment on this chapter, so he gave a summary of the chapter. So, you know, being a devotee, that's the most auspicious. And next is following regular principles of human life. Prabhupada gave us both of these because he told us to follow the four regulative principles. Because that's not bhakti, you know, avoiding meat and not gambling and not drinking. Right? That's not bhakti. That's not angas of bhakti. Those are what he said, the regular principles enjoined in the Vedic. This is the usual Vedic scenario of like jnana yoga. If you look at the piety in the bhakti loka, you'll see, I think it comes under the title of Niyamagraha. If you look in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's book, Sri Bhaktialoka, which is giving light on the path of bhakti, then you'll see in the Niyamagraha section, there's the different, it describes going up and up different levels of religion. So it describes what are the, like, the principles of each, of karma yoga, jnana, and bhakti, like this. And you said that jnana and bhakti are very similar. You can see that the components are very similar. So he's talking about the vidhi and the nisheda in each system of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. So jnana and bhakti are very similar. I don't have those notes with me or the book with me right now, but I remember this point. So in other words, if you just add some devotion to jnana yoga, then you get bhakti. Because you have a person who's already controlling the senses, and he's realizing he's not the body, and he's not looking for some sense gratification from his religiosity, his following of Dharma is based on something a little higher. So these things are meant for augmenting our path of bhakti. Bhakti is always glorified as the most powerful process, and we should always have full faith in that. But we should also, you know, doubt our own ability to, you know, perform, not our own ability, but our own adhikar at the present moment, and that we require some assistance to help to support our devotion. So that we, you know, to make sure that we remain fixed in sense control and so forth. So now Krishna concludes the chapter here with two verses. One of them negative and one of them positive. Here's the negative one. Yashastra vidam utsrijya vartate kama karataha dasa siddhim avapnoti nasukhim na param gatim. He who discards scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whims attains neither perfection nor happiness nor the supreme destination. Prabhupada has written in the middle of the first paragraph, in the human form of life, a living entity is expected to be sane and to follow the regulations given for elevating his life to the highest platform. But if he does not follow them, then he degrades himself. But even if he follows the rules and regulations and moral principles, and ultimately does not come to the stage of understanding the Supreme Lord, then all his knowledge becomes spoiled. And even if he accepts the existence of God, if he does not engage himself in the service of the Lord, his attempts are spoiled. Therefore, one should gradually raise himself to the platform of Krishna consciousness and devotional service. It is then and there that he can attain the highest perfectional stage, not otherwise. So that's a very nice summary of the different stages. Baladev Vidyabhusan has written, only a person with faith in Shastra can get Shreyas. He gets purified by performing religious duty, which comes from Shastra. Therefore, an intelligent person will follow Shastra. He acts according to the Lord's will. Prabhupada has gave a class on this verse. He said, we are not perfect. Therefore, we have to follow the footprints of the perfect. And that is given in the Shastra, whom you have to follow. We have to understand Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna understood. Then you are in the parampara. And if you understand Gita as some so-called scholar understands, then you are not understanding the Gita. This is the secret. Here we have got so many commentaries on Gita, as one thinks, as if Krishna left Gita to be commented by some rascals to understand. Why? He said Bhagavad Gita clearly. Why is it to be interpreted by some rascals? Did Krishna mean that? I leave Bhagavad Gita ambiguous, and some learned scholar will come. He will explain. What is this nonsense? Everything is clear. Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning it is said that dharma kshetre kurukshetre samavita yuyutsava. Now, why should it be interpreted? Dharma kshetra means this, kurukshetra means that. Why? It is clear. Kurukshetra still exists. Everyone knows, and that is dharma kshetra. Everyone knows. It is not known now. From the Vedic age, Kurukshetra Dharmam Acharet. Still, people go there to perform ritualistic ceremonies. So Kurukshetra is still there, and it is Dharmakshetra from time immemorial. Why should it be interpreted? Therefore, we are presenting Bhagavad Gita as it is. Therefore, it is being effective. Before me, many Swamis went to the Western countries to preach this Gita. Not a single person became a devotee of Krishna. Not a single person. There is not in the history. And now Gita is being presented as it is. Thousands are becoming devotees of Krishna. This is the secret. People give me credit that, Swamiji, you have done wonderful. Nobody could do it. I am not a wonderful man. Neither do I know anything magic. I have presented Bhagavad Gita as it is. That's all. This is the secret. Anyone can do that. You present the thing as it is. Don't adulterate it. Then it will be accepted. Just like Paramana, kheer. Kheer is very nice food, but if you adulterate it with some grains of sand, it is spoiled. So that was being done. Bhagavad Gita is the science of God, the spiritual science, but it was being adulterated by so many grains of sand, so people could not understand it. We do not present Bhagavad Gita with some adulteration. We're talking about people giving up the Shastra, right? The meaning of the Shastra. Prabhupada also said in another time, that was in Ahmedabad in 1972. And this one is from Bombay, 1972. Anyone who doesn't care for the instruction given in the Shastra, just like anyone who doesn't care for the law of the state, what kind of man is he? He's a loafer, an outlaw. He's not a respectable citizen. Similarly, anyone who does not follow the Shastric injunctions. Shastras are meant for human beings, not for the cats and dogs and hogs. A law is meant for the human being, not for cats and dogs. Therefore, we have to follow the Shastric injunctions. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, or Vyasadeva says in the Puranas, in Vedanta Sutra, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Anadi Bahimuk Jiva Krishna Bhulya Gela Ateva Krishna Veda Purana Karila. For what? What for these Vedas and Puranas are meant? Because we have forgotten Krishna. We have forgotten Krishna. Therefore, to revive our Krishna consciousness, so many Vedic literatures are there. So Shastra Chakshushat, everything we have to take from the Shastra, because we are blind now. Shastra Chakshushat. Our Shastra Gyan. Because the spiritual master enlightens the disciple with Shastra Gyan. Therefore he is spiritual master. If the spiritual master bluffs the disciple, then he is not spiritual master. Bluffing. No. Agyana timarandasya gyananjana shalakaya. Chakshu unmilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namah. This is guru. Guru means he'll always enlighten the disciple with the light of Shastra. Not that he will say, there is no need of Shastra, I am incarnation. Whatever I speak, you take it. No, this is rascal. You should immediately, who has no reference to Shastra, immediately take him as rascal number one. This is the conclusion. So Prabhupada, see, kama karata means a whimsical, whimsically done according to one's own desires. So he comments on this in this shloka. Because if one gives up Shastra, he has nothing left than kama karata, only his own whims. Word kama karata is very significant. Now I'm reading from the purport, second paragraph. A person who knowingly violates the rules acts in lust. He knows that this is forbidden, but still he acts. This is called acting whimsically. He knows that this should be done, but still he does not do it. Therefore he is called whimsical. Such persons are destined to be condemned by the Supreme Lord. Such persons cannot have the perfection which is meant for human life. The human life is especially meant for purifying one's existence. And one who does not follow the rules and regulations cannot purify himself, nor can he attain the real stage of happiness. Okay, last verse. So here's some more positive note. Right? So he says that one should end on something sweet. So it's more positive. Tasmat chastram pramanam te karya karya vivastitau yatva shastra vedanuktam karma kartam iharhasi. One should therefore understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that he may gradually be elevated. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan has written that, thus, only Shastra is authoritative in determining correct and incorrect behavior. Shastra's conclusion is to perform bhakti. Knowing this, you'll become qualified to live an active devotional life. Theists attain the supreme destination by faith in the Lord. And the faithless atheist goes to hell. This is the meaning of this chapter. So if we don't accept Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then we're left to just accept our own mind. But that guru, the mind guru, will keep you in the path of birth and death forever. So Shastra both describes acts that bind and acts that liberate. So naturally we avoid A, the first one, and we accept B, the second one. Because in the Karmakanda there are many acts that bind or keep one in the material world. Prabhupada writes, as stated in the 15th chapter, all the rules and regulations of the Vedas are meant for knowing Krishna. If one understands Krishna from the Gita and becomes situated in Krishna consciousness, engaging himself in devotional service, he has reached the highest perfection of knowledge offered by the Vedas. Lord Chaitanya made this process very easy. He asked people simply to chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and to engage in devotional service of the Lord, eat the remnants of foodstuffs offered to the deity. One who is directly engaged in all these devotional activities is to be understood as having studied all the Vedas. He has come to the conclusion perfectly. Of course, for the ordinary persons who are not in Krishna consciousness or who are not engaged in devotional service, what is to be done and not to be done must be decided by the injunctions of the Vedas. One should act accordingly, without argument. That is called following the principles of Shastra. Shastra is without the four defects that are visible in the conditioned soul: imperfect senses, cheating, committing mistakes, and being illusion. These four principal defects in conditioned life disqualify one from putting forth rules and regulations. Therefore, the rules and regulations, as described in the Shastra, being above these defects, are accepted without alteration by all saints, acharyas, and great souls. In India, there are many parties of spiritual understanding, generally classified as two, impersonalist and and impersonalist and personalist. Both of them, however, lead their lives according to the principles of the Vedas. Without following the principles of Vedas, one cannot elevate himself to the perfectional stage. One who actually therefore understands the purport of the Shastra is considered fortunate. In human society, aversion to the principles of understanding the Supreme Lord is the cause of all fall downs. That is the greatest offense of human life. Therefore, Maya, the material energy of the Lord, is always giving us trouble in the shape of the threefold miseries. This material energy is constituted of the three modes. One has to raise himself at least to the mode of goodness before the path to understanding the Supreme Lord can be opened. Without raising oneself to the standard of the mode of goodness, one remains in ignorance and passion, which are the cause of demoniac life. Those in the modes of passion and ignorance deride the scriptures, deride the holy men, and deride the proper understanding of the Lord. They disobey the instructions of the spiritual master, and they do not care for the regulations of the scriptures. In spite of hearing the glories of devotional service, they are not attracted. Thus they manufacture their own way of elevation. These are some of the defects of human society which lead to the demoniac status of life. If, however, one is able to be guided by a proper and bona fide spiritual master who can lead one to the path of elevation to the higher stage, then one's life becomes successful. So people are generally suffering because they're influenced by tamas and rajas. And so they're very much affected by all of these bad qualities which Krishna has described in this chapter, the asuri sampat. So therefore the Shastra gives regulations and dharma, mainly varnashram dharma, and general rules and regulations, as was described in the beginning, that there's these divine qualities, cleanliness, and it was all based on the varnashram dharma. There are certain things that certain persons should concentrate on, and then there are also general things like ahimsa, you know, non-violence, and so many other qualities. Let's just look at them again. For everyone, we had especially arjavam, simplicity, and in truthfulness, freedom from anger, peacefulness, non-enviousness, freedom from greed, being merciful, being gentle, being determined, like this. There are so many things that one can try to develop. And so the general Vedic scenario brings one in this way to pious life, to at least to the mode of goodness. And here Prabhupada says that one has to raise himself at least to goodness before the path of understanding the Lord can be open. So that's why Prabhupada gave us some basic principles, you know, rising early, being very clean, chanting the holy name. Chanting the holy name is the highest thing, but it automatically helps in all of the other things. So waking early, being clean, and following four regular principles. These are like basic things to help us to chant the holy name. And then we can get more benefit from chanting the holy name. There are other Vaishnava organizations that give Nam Diksha without so much stress on these other things. But Prabhupada, understanding that the effectiveness of the mantra will be hampered by the sinfulness, and so therefore he said that he presented Krishna consciousness in such a way so that it will be most effective. Because otherwise you can chant for a long time and not get very much benefit if you're affected by these lower things. It's like we say starting a fire and pouring water on it at the same time. So in order to make it effective, Prabhupada has created this practice for us. He's instituted both of these things together. And so this is based on Shastra, and therefore it's helpful for us to hear these qualities and to understand them, to understand the demoniac quality, because actually within us we have the demon and we have the devotee both. And there's a kind of tug of war or struggle, internal struggle going on. within ourselves. So to hear about these demoniac qualities, sometimes we can relate to them very much because we say, yes, I'm like that. By hearing the conclusion of this shastra and hearing the commentaries, it will give us strength to actually conquer those things and to focus more on bhakti. Because the more faith and more devotion we have, the more we'll be able to conquer these things and come to goodness and beyond by the strength of bhakti. And that's the best way. Okay, so we'll stop and ask for questions now. Yeah, those are very lucky demons. Because, usually a demon's not killed by the Lord. Well, that just shows how merciful the Lord is, that he gives someone who's so unqualified, an evil person, the same result as a strict, regulated Brahmavadi, who's a jnani, who's doing bhakti mishra jnana. Right? They're still considered abhishuddha buddhaya because they have the beta drishti. And that was described in reference to Lord Brahma, or those who go to the planet of Lord Brahma. And this is the drawback in the jnani who goes to Sayuja. This is described in 325.16. And this was brought up before. Here, this is 17. Okay, where am I going here? Oh, here it is. 16, okay. When one is completely cleansed of the impurities of lust and greed produced from the false identification of the body as I and bodily possessions as mine, one's mind becomes purified. In that pure state, he transcends the stage of so-called material happiness and distress. The commentary by Prabhupada, he says, kama and loba are the seeds of material existence, or the symptoms of material existence. Everyone always desires to possess something. And that is because they have a separate vision from the Lord. So if Lord Brahma has that, then at the end of his life, he enters into Mahavishnu, and then he takes birth again as Brahma. So the Brahmavadis, they have a kind of they're not one with the Lord completely in their heart. So there's a kind of beta drishti also. Although they say everything's one, there's still anadrita yushabhanangraya. There's some standoffishness, maybe we could say. The person not surrendering to the Lord. But they mix in a little bhakti with their jnana, so they go to the place. So the demons, they just kind of, they can't progress beyond that point because they're not really surrendered to the Lord. But that's like the highest that he can give them. The highest that they can actually position, that they can maintain, is Sayuja Mukti. And that's above the modes of nature, but it's without any surrender or any love to the Lord. It seems so. I mean, just like Putana, but in her last life, she was the sister of Bali Maharaj. And she was a little bit attracted to Vamana. She was very attracted to Vamana Dev. But then later, when she saw Vamana, how he tied up her brother and sent him to hell, even after he already donated everything that he owned, then he thought that I'll kill him. Like this. So she had these two different ideas. But because of her relationship with Bali, therefore she was given Sarupya and like this as a maidservant in Goloka. And there are other examples. Kamsa got Sarupya Mukti. And there were some other demons that were like related to Pundraka. So each case was slightly different, but there was always something, either a relationship with a great devotee or some special feature which somehow moved the Lord to give them something even more. But I haven't seen that there's a kind of general rule about that. It just seems according to the individual. Yes, you had a question there in the back? And often there's some background. In what? On Garga Samhita. Yeah, just like there was some person, I forget who it was, he was picking flowers in a garden, and Mahadev came, and then he was actually picking flowers for the deity, Bhagavan Murti. And then because Mahadev had promised Devi that if anyone will come and pick lotuses here, then I'll curse them to become a demon. So it was actually a devotee picking flowers when he got cursed by Mahadev to become a demon. And he ended up in Vraj Leela. But then, of course, you know, the Lord accepted him back. So, like, someone like that would get Sarupya Mukti, you know, because he didn't actually have, like, a aversion to the Lord or Beta Drishti. He just made a mistake. He got cursed. So there are like situations like that also, where generally we see that happens. In some cases it was like this. Takes some preparation to present the answer according to, you know, with all the examples. And I have to look into the Garga Samhita demonology. You know, I didn't describe this from Baladeva Vidyabhushan's commentary. Well, like, I can at least say that Dhritarashtra and his son, Duryodhana, they were both demigods. Dhritarashtra's name was Bhaga, and Duryodhana was Kali. So, and many of them, they were different demigods just playing a role. That's generally what happens. Although, Shishupal and Dantavakra, or in the other Leelas, that they're not always Jaya and Vijaya. So they're actually demons. And then Krishna kills them and gives them Suyuja usually. But, you know, those who get cursed and or somehow just, you know, by some accident, then they're demons, but there's some hope for them. But there's other ones, at least according to Baladeva's commentary, said that the other ones have no hope because they're truly envious of the Lord. They, like, hate Krishna. And the only way that they can get purified is if they enter Krishna Leela and, you know, they're thinking of him always, and then the Lord kills them. And then they can get liberation. But otherwise, they're, you know, tan aham dvishatang kurang sang sareshu naradaman. They're constantly or perpetually condemned. See, there's a difference between the word perpetually and eternally, because we don't have the idea of eternal damnation, but perpetual means as long as there's a certain circumstance or state of mind, then it will continue on ad infinitum. So that's why Prabhupada uses this word here, perpetually. I perpetually cast them. Kshipami ajasram asubhan asurshyeva yonishu. This is our Siddhanta. And it makes perfect sense to me, at least. I think for most of you can also agree with this. Not that I can think of right offhand. There are statements that only Krishna's killing gives them liberation. And the Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur has commented like that in the Bhagavatam, I believe, as well as in other places, maybe even in the Gita. But and he gives the examples of these six, you know, incarnations of Jaya and Vijaya, that they got some, you know, elevated, they were somewhat elevated in their next lives, but they didn't get liberation. And only when Krishna killed them, they got liberation. So there are statements like that that I've seen, that only Krishna gives liberation. Right, and then he took birth as Kalanimi and then as Kamsa. And before that he was one of the sons of Marichi, or he was Marichi. Right? No. Anyway, the sons of Marichi became Kalanimi's sons. Well, that seems like a very plausible reason. It certainly could be one of the reasons why he puts them. I mean, other than the fact that they deserve it, but he may also have that, you know, motive. But I haven't read that anywhere. I haven't heard that, but it's quite possible. Yes. I would agree with such a presentation. Yeah, that's true. But then he can also send them back down again. Or when they come to human beings, they could be the hunters in the forest, right? And then when they commit all the sins, then back they go, right? Demons and demons with no hope. So it would take some very special miracle to save such kind of persons, you know. You know, like if they, in the animal species, if they take prasadam, right? Then they could be then they could get some benefit. Maybe come to a normal human life in the next life. And then the Lord will then, you know, monitor him carefully to see what he will do. Looks like Chaitanya Charman is formulating some deep questions there. So. Let's ask Kinchana Krishna first. Give him more time to formulate his questions. So. Right. Those who are born in forest dweller families are forced to act the way they are according to their circumstance. Yeah, good question. Because they're antajas, they're not following any dharma whatsoever. I think that the only way is that if somehow or other, from the kindness of their heart, they help some sadhu or maybe some king or some rishi in the forest, somehow they do some seva, then by that, then they would sooner or later get a good birth and then have a chance. It's a good question, actually. But fortunately, you know, rishis and sadhus, they stay in the forest and they could possibly do something for them. If they had some even spark of goodness in their heart or kindness or any good quality that might come and they might get some benefit in that way. And close the door. Sounds like they're having a big kirtan there. It's only with three people. And it sounds as usual. Is the Bhagavad Gita, what's the word? Huh? orient to Kaliyuga. Well, this Kali Yuga has already been going on for some 5,000 years or so. So that's a long time. I mean, for us at least, from our standpoint. And persons have been performing karma yoga quite easily, even up until the last few hundred years, I would imagine. And even now in India, people know what is karma yoga. And people from wealthy families, they know, like the Hindujas, the Birlas, the Dattas, they do give donations and build temples and hospitals and all these things. So they have the idea of karma yoga. So that's the first section of the Gita to do that. And if they have the idea of the Lord, which most of them also do, that is even further development, that would bring us to the verses Atachitam samadhatum nashaknosi maishtanam abhyasana yoganatato and further, mad artam karma kum. So to do the work for the Lord or to do some sadhana, something like that. So, and patram pushpam palam toyam, that's for people in Kali Yuga also. They can scrape up the little bit of devotion in their heart and offer something to the Lord. They may be bereft of, opulence, but at least they can offer something. So, it seems that because Krishna spoke the Gita at the very end of the Dwapara Yuga. So it seems, that we would be foolish to think that it's just an accident. It seems that it must be for Kali Yuga. And, it's unfortunate that people in India even the people in India are not taking the Gita so seriously, at least the major portion of the population. Even when I was preaching in Gujarat in 86, I was studying so many Gita verses to prepare myself for preaching in the college. And then when I started giving lectures, I was quoting verses like left and right, maybe 50 verses in one class or something like that. And then the students were so shocked, they couldn't believe it. And then when I asked them, how many, let's have a show of hands, how many people have read the Bhagavad Gita, raise your hand. Like 2 people out of 100 raised their hands. It's like, and I did this, maybe at least 50 or 100 times in my preaching in that state. And so very few people actually read the Bhagavad Gita, even read it, what to speak of studied it. So it seems that the situation is kind of turned in a very bad way, probably due to the leadership of the country. But the principles given in the Gita can be very easily applied. And that was the thing that kind of irked Srila Prabhupada, because everything was so simple. And he saw that people weren't doing it, and they were being directed against, accepting or implementing the Gita's advice because of the stupid leaders who are just completely like mudhas and uncultured people who are introducing Western ideas more and more and more into the country, like abortion, cow killing, and things which are obviously really grossly sinful. So, I guess it's debatable. It's debatable. It's subjective, what we're speaking about. But the principles in the Gita are very simple. Just to offer at least part of the result of one's work and then gradually, you know, push start, you know, your soul to perform bhakti yoga. Right? You know, because if someone's doing nishkam karma yoga, then all you have to do is introduce the mantra to him and get him to offer his food to the to a picture of the Lord in his home. Then he's already a devotee, you know, more or less, just with some karma mishra bhakti, you know. So I think that we should have faith that it can be very easily implemented and that it is for Kali Yuga, but it's just that people are being misled by poor leadership and just go on that basis. Wouldn't you agree, Radha Shyam Prabhu? He's continuing, right? He hasn't given up the principles of Gita, preaching the Gita to the people of Maharashtra just because, right? It's, I think if we, you know, we accept that it can be done, then we'll do it. Kali Kale Nama Rupe Krishna Avatar. Huh? How about Chandalopi Dvijashreshtas Hari Bhakti Parayana? Even the Chandalas, they become best of the Brahmins if they perform Hari Bhakti. So in Kali Yuga, there's a lot of Chandalas, Malechas and Chandalas. So if they perform Hari Bhakti, then they can become the best Brahmins. If the Bhagavatam is meant for Kali Yuga, then the Gita certainly is too. Because the Bhagavatam is describing Ananya Bhakti and begins where the Mahabharata left off. And the Bhagavad Gita is the initial principles which are the substratum for the further development in the Bhagavatam. So it certainly can be applied also. I don't know, I don't have any Vedic references that describe the Gita particularly for Kali Yuga. But anyway, by the logic, if the Bhagavatam is meant, then the Gita must also be meant. Something else? Yes. Rurubis. You're trying to, why not just accept the, you know, the simple statements that people who are sinful in so many specified ways, they go to certain hells. And, you know, whoever, you know, the creatures that are in the river biting the why be concerned about them so much? Obviously, they're there for the same reasons. They committed similar sins. They're all biting each other, you know, in that river. Right? Like creamy bhoja? Creamy bhoja. It's all worms all biting each other, you know. They're having a big bhojan, right? With, right? Creamy bhojan. Yeah, with a K, creamy. So, I don't know. Yamadutas are also sinful, but they're getting some mercy by Yamaraj to engage them in his seva. And this way they get their, you know, their way out from their sinful life by serving Yamaraj. And the ghosts also that Mahadev accepts, the Bhutas and so forth, they get some elevation from associating with him. But it's sure that the Yamadutas were also very sinful. And it's also sure that whoever's, you know, in whatever creatures are in the hellish planets biting and causing pain to others, they're also sinful. And the dogs that are on the path leading to Patala Loka, then they're also sinful living entities. And they're just, you know, they're being utilized to do something, you know, useful by these demigods. The ghosts also come at certain times to disturb those who are sleeping during the sanyas, because you're not supposed to sleep during the sanyas. So if you sleep at, 6 o'clock in the morning, then pretty good chance that you'll be harassed by a ghost. And it's just, it's like the law of karma. Everything's in the universe is just kind of structured in that way, and everything fits in. So everyone plays their role, even in hell. I remember that below all the planets is Yamaraja's planet. I vaguely remember reading something like what you're saying. They're like underneath all of the other lower planets. I think that's correct, but I can't remember. My narakology. Okay, we'll stop now. It's very late.